If you want to explore unique perspectives that are rarely expressed in mainstream media, you are listening to the right channel. This is CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC.
Hello, and welcome to the Canadian Philosophy Show. My name is Mihai Kovacer. I'm here behind the mic again to host a two-episode series here on paradoxes in philosophy. So this is a topic that I think is pretty interesting. We'll get into it in just a moment. But before that, I also want to introduce our co-hosts. I've got here with me Aaron Wang and Brendan Brownlee to help me with this discussion. Paradoxes in philosophy cover a wide range of schools of thought, of aspects of philosophy, of branches of the practice. I mentioned in the description of the show that things like metaphysics, logic, and ethics will all feature at different points in this little two-episode series. So I don't want to dive too deep into the technicality of all of these, especially when it comes to contemporary paradoxes, because we are always finding these apparent contradictions in our thinking, especially in the fields of mathematics and logical applications of mathematics. There's a number of paradoxes, that some that have yet to be solved. For the purposes of this little series, I think we'll dive into a little bit of the history of paradoxes, why they're important in philosophical thought, and then go over a couple of examples. Just to start, just to clarify exactly what we're talking about, if you look up the definition of paradox in the dictionary, you get something like the following. So definition one, such as a person, situation, or action, having seemingly contradictory qualities or phases. And secondly, a statement that is seemingly contradictory or opposed to common sense and yet is perhaps true. And then most interesting is this last portion here, an argument that apparently derives self-contradictory conclusions by valid deduction from acceptable premises. So I want to make the distinction a little bit, because, you know, I many of us throw the term paradox around on a regular basis. It can mean, and even in this context that we're going to be talking about today, could mean something that is just seemingly contradictory off of sort of a common sense way of thinking about things. But more specifically, a lot of these paradoxes are actually, it's a logical term. So it means you, through valid inference, reach somehow two or more self-contradictory conclusions. Again, by valid deduction and acceptable premises. So there seems to be nothing wrong with the argument, and you still end up with a contradiction somehow. Now, as we'll see in many of these cases, especially the ancient cases, there are paradoxes that we simply didn't have the means to find the appropriate conclusions for at the time, as far as theoretical knowledge went. The kinds of paradoxes we're talking about here today, mostly logical ones, but also some sort of common sense, everyday sort of examples.
I do want to kind of note, even though I don't have a super strong background in mathematics, I only took the minor program while I was in university. The way mathematics functions today, paradoxes aren't really allowed, and that's usually because if you have a contradiction, it's because of the exact reasons you just mentioned, where you've assumed something you were not supposed to assume, or you've made an invalid inference. And because that covers like the vast majority of mathematical mistakes in mathematical proofs, generally speaking, it's not so much, I would say, that we don't have paradoxes, but if there is such a thing as a paradox, then it would be treated as a definition and it would be explained, or it would be treated as a necessary premise in creating a proof or a theorem. So just kind of I know philosophy and math kind of have grown into very different traditions and how they see things, but I just wanted to add that.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Thanks for that. That's an important distinction. Right then. So today on this particular episode, I want to discuss two paradoxes, or maybe two sets of paradoxes from the ancient world, just to give a bit of background and to show that this has been an important part of philosophy for a long time. So the first of these is what's called Euthyphro's dilemma. So I'm going to give a little bit of background as to what Euthyphro is, and then what the dilemma is, and from there we can discuss it a bit, we can talk about what you think, and I'll tie this back a little bit to my meta-ethics episode that I did a little while ago, because it sort of has to do with that those distinctions that I drew there. So Euthyphro is a Socratic dialogue by Plato. So as many of you might be familiar, Socrates never wrote anything down. They thought that writing was highly inferior to speaking as a rhetorical practice. And Plato decided to transcribe or sometimes invent, it's hard to say, some of these Socratic dialogues that Socrates would have supposedly had in the city with the people. So this is a dialogue between Socrates and a friend of his, Euthyphro. So that's the name of the work, that's the name of his friend. And it's a really important dialogue because it covers the meanings of piety and justice for Socrates and for his contemporaries. They, as philosophers, were very interested in the idea of justice, what is pious, what is holy, what is just. And this dialogue goes about Euthyphro first, and then Socrates' reply to Euthyphro as to what these definitions mean. And the way this dialogue starts is that it's Euthyphro is he is charging his father on the grounds of killing one of their household slaves or workers. So I'm just going to read here. Socrates is preparing to also go to court against the charges against him on the grounds of impiety. So there's two different sort of court proceedings going on here. So Euthyphro tells Socrates that he is going to court himself to prosecute his father for binding a worker in chains and leaving him to die. This has granted him the ire of his own family, who believe his father was in the right. The worker had killed a fellow worker, which they believe exempts his father from liability for leaving him bound in the ditch to starve to death. Since Euthyphro seems assured of himself, Socrates asks him to define piety. So that's how this discussion starts, because Socrates himself is also being charged with impiety, which was at that time, a valid legal charge that you could bring against someone for sort of violating the rules of proper social conduct or the things that are considered to be good by the gods. So without too much further ado, I'll say that the discussion starts like that. And basically, what Socrates ends up asking Euthyphro, which is the sort of central question behind this dialogue, is something pious or holy because it is loved by the gods, or do the gods love that which is pious? So the difference being, are objects inherently pious, or actions, are they inherently pious or holy, or are they only holy because they are loved by the gods?
And that covers the background of it, and especially the dramatic background. We have to remember that we're reading dialogues with characters, and Socrates is proceeding into an event. The next dialogue that actually follows this and the usual corpus is the apology, where he's going to go on trial and defend himself here. So this is the sort of prequel to that in a way. We get a little back and forth between Euthyphro on piety, and then he's going to defend himself on pious or against charges of impiety. Specifically, he's also charged with corrupting the youth.
Yeah.
So two charges there. But yeah, Euthyphro, he is as far as I remember, he's a priest. And Socrates gets interested. He's like, oh, well, then you could tell me about this thing I'm interested in, especially because I'm going to go talk about it like right now. What's piety? And he says, quoting here, "I do indeed say that the pious is what all the gods love, and the opposite, what all the gods hate, is impious." And this initiates the paradoxical dilemma. Euthyphro has initiated himself by committing to this definition of what is pious as what the gods love. And Socrates is going to push that to essentially its limit.
Yeah.
And initiating the paradoxical character of the dilemma.
Yeah. So I'll clarify here. So Euthyphro, as you say, starts with that definition. Actually, Euthyphro's first definition is, he says, what I'm doing right now is pious, prosecuting my own father for manslaughter because I think he unjustly killed this worker. Socrates rejects that, saying that it's not a definition, it's just an example. So you need to give me some, like, proper definitions.
Yeah, the first...
Okay.
Yeah, and the first definition he gives is...
Yeah, so then the first definition, he says, okay, well, piety is what is pleasing to the gods. Socrates is like, great, that sounds really cool, except we have a lot of gods. And in our stories, these gods don't always have the same interests. So it's more than possible that gods are going to disagree on what they find pleasing. So that's the problem with Euthyphro's first, or his second definition, let's say, his first real theoretical definition. Socrates says, okay, if that's what the gods love, then what if the gods disagree on what they like? Now, what's pious? The reason this is a logical fallacy is because what if one god says, I like this, and another god says, I don't like that same thing? Now you have a thing that is pious and impious at the same time, which is kind of a contradiction. Is exactly a contradiction. So the example from the book, Euthyphro tries to argue back, saying that not even the gods would disagree on certain things, like killing someone unjustly should be punished. But Socrates argues back, says, well, what are the specifics? What is the justification? How much justification actually exists for this action? So he's saying, like, yeah, okay, maybe there's some things that the gods are pretty unanimous on, but even then, there's some details missing. So here's the initial dilemma is like, okay, if piety is just what the gods love, what if they disagree? And so then Euthyphro will go to amend his definition again. But first, I'll just put that to you folks if you have anything to add.
I think that this paradox is interesting because the fundamental question is actually more human than you might think. Mm-hmm. And I guess I'm coming at this more from the computer science math perspective, but essentially the question here is, if you have a group of people and they form a consensus about something they believe is good or honorable, or you can use whatever word you want there, then how do they know that thing is good in its form? Is it because they have decided it as a group, or is it how they came to that decision? Is there a process or a principle involved that makes that good? So is the goodness based off of the decision of the group, or is it based off of some other principle or process? Often today in our society, it's both. You kind of have to think that you have people who are operating in good faith with a good process. But I do think it's a worthwhile discussion.
I think that's a fair way to put it. And that's exactly what happens then in the next part of the dialogue is you've had this objection that what if the gods disagree? So Euthyphro says, okay, how about what's pious is what all the gods love and what's impious is what they all hate. But then that's when our dilemma comes in. And that's when Socrates asks him the question, is the pious loved by the gods because it is pious? Or is it pious simply because it is loved by the gods? And Socrates then sort of employs a rhetorical technique here to make his point. He talks about something being carried. And he says something called carried is not that way because it's something inherent in the object. Like, it's not that an object has this quality in it of being carried. It's what we are applying to it. We are carrying it and therefore giving it that quality of being carried, which admittedly is a bit of a linguistic, you know, twist maneuver to make his point. But that highlights the idea of what we're saying here. Is it that we give that quality to the thing, or is it that it has that quality in and of itself? And this was really important because if you're thinking about ethical theory, if you're thinking about how can we act well and what does it mean to be a good person in the world, well, you have to be able to answer the question, at least, you know, for yourself, do you approach things that have inherently good qualities in them as ethical goods, or are you the only thing that's giving that quality to it? In a sense, if we make a piece of art, is it good because it's a production of art, of human creation, or is it only good because there's people around to see it? Right? If a tree falls in the woods, kind of questions.
Yeah, this is an interesting case of, I don't know if this term is used by multiple philosophers, but I'm thinking specifically of like reification. So I think the carried example is, it's good. Is something care, like, so something is carried and we have this word and we can kind of reify the property or the process of being carried, and we can point at it, and we might fall into philosophical problems asking, okay, well, where is the carriedness of the object, you know, and we might bust out our microscopes and start looking for carriedness. But that's to fall into the philosophical problem of reifying things, you know, being carried is just a process. But it's interesting when you start thinking not just of processes, but of concepts like piety. Piety seems to be something we can actually kind of conjure an image of in our head. We have stereotypical kind of images of character that are pious. So is there really something about the people who are pious? It's an interesting thing because things do exist. There are particular things. That's what reification is, res, you know, thing in Latin. So there are things. It's just about not mistaking things like being carried for things like a tree. And the question becomes, in this case, is piety a thing like a tree or a thing like being carried? And that's to confront the philosophical problem of reification in this case.
Interesting. I haven't heard it explained in that way. And I think that's that gives another perspective to it, which I appreciate. Because this is what ties it back to the ethical discussion or the meta-ethical discussion that I was talking about that I had a little while ago, which is that this forms the foundation, the fundamental distinction between realism and anti-realism, essentially, in ethics. So just to briefly bring that back, and you can go listen to that episode if you'd like, but just to bring that back briefly, so this is the dilemma, right? If there is a good thing, what are the features that make it good? And we can call that realism, where there are qualities inherent in things in the world. Something good is inherently good on its own. The second interpretation you can take is the gods impose goodness on something through their will. Or we could say we as humans impose goodness on things that we call good. And that's what you would call anti-realism. So there's, in a sense, nothing but the reaction to a thing. It's just we react to something we see or feel or experience, we say that's good, and then we claim that it has that quality. Again, the problem with that is, first of all, do you have a justification for it? And second of all, what if people disagree? So that's exactly what Socrates tries to dive in on. What happens, though, is that Socrates then, and sorry, just to wrap that train of thought up, that's the distinction between realism and anti-realism in meta-ethics, which, again, we go into a bit of a longer discussion about that in a previous episode that you can go watch or listen to. And so what happens then is, we won't get into all of this because it's not exactly the focus of the discussion, but just to give you the rest of the context, in the second half of the dialogue, Socrates defines piety as a part of justice, and then they go into a discussion of what is justice, how is piety a part of it, what is the proof, and Euthyphro says, okay, maybe piety is some this concern with looking after the gods, for example, but Socrates replies, well, that's kind of hubristic or egotistical, because now you're saying you can make the gods, you can improve the well-being of the gods by looking after them, which is kind of a ridiculous notion. So finally, they land on a definition that piety is an art of sacrifice and prayer. But you can read Euthyphro. It's actually quite an easy read and not that long. So if you want to get a bit of the rest of that discussion on justice in particular. But I want to just focus on the paradoxical nature of that question of, is something good because it has that quality or because something gave it that quality. And what makes this a paradox is not necessarily that there is a logical paradox here in the way we'll see in just a moment. It's more of one of those common sense paradox I explained just earlier, that there's some kind of conceptual analysis that could go two ways that contradict each other. And that's one kind of paradox that you might have in philosophy. So you have questions like this. Is it good because it's loved or good because it's good? And of course, like I said, that has spawned a whole other school of thinking. But at the time, it was just a matter of, well, it was a matter of Socrates saving his own skin because he was about to go into court and talk about this for an hour straight. So he should know what he's talking about. But also, in typical Socratic fashion, he puts his friend, who's a priest, on the spot and says, you don't know much about the thing you do for a living. So, but yeah, I will throw it back and ask you folks, is there... What do you think of this paradox? You know, what do you think is contributing to the confusion they're having? And maybe where do you stand on this issue?
I know this will sound pretty dumb, but I'm going to say it anyway. It almost seems like this type of paradox is part of the nature of human society. And also, like, you could argue kind of like the nature of the human mind, and I'm not a psychologist, but if you think about like subconscious versus unconscious things, like, or even just like perception in terms of knowing things, so I guess this is more epistemology, you don't always know how you know something, but sometimes you know that you know something. Through and that's kind of the question here of, well, if something is good because someone decided it so, well, then you should be able to point to the person who decided that. And then if they are a good person, then, you know, it is good. Or if you look at it the other way, there is something that is good, that person exists in the world and can see and identify that thing. They show you that thing, and then you also know that thing, and you know that thing is good. It kind of... This is, I think, where things break down, is between the world of ideas and the physical world, and what things correlate or correspond, and what things may not correlate or correspond. Yeah. Because once you start talking about, like... religious or specific ideas, it's kind of hard to know your way in terms of, is there always a physical analogy to things? One of the things I appreciate about modern mathematics is essentially every type of modern mathematics will relate back to a physical phenomenon that we actually use to ground a lot of our stuff. And so there's a lot of very, very strange mathematics, but all of that strange mathematics, you can always trace it back to some real phenomenon that is observable, and it's something that you can say, like a mathematician can go and study and look at again and say, like, okay, well, we said this about this thing, we characterized it in these ways, another mathematician can go and make those exact same observations. And so because we have that kind of similar base of perceptual understanding, we can be very rigorous with our ideas and know when like mistakes are made, but I think it's very difficult to do that necessarily in philosophy, or there's some different things at play.
Yeah. So this whole metaphysical discussion, we'll get into a little more in the second episode when we discuss identity and, you know, I'll tie John Locke into this discussion quite a bit because we'll be talking about the ship of Theseus and some of the Christian tradition paradoxes that philosophers have questioned over history. So we'll move ahead in history a little ways. But I think this goes back to what Brandon was saying, that when we're talking about concepts like piety, you're right that unless you can make the claim that piety is somehow a characteristic that objects can possess that we can identify, then it's sort of... If you claim that, then your job is almost easier because you can say that in a sense, because you do still, your job then is to prove what are the characteristics of piety? How do you know something is good is your next job. But if you think that it sits apart from these physical things, like Brandon said, into this world of conceptual things, and that it's just applied by us, it's a title, it's a label, then in a sense, it might be harder to ground your argument. But on the other hand, you might be able to say, okay, we seem to call this set of things pious. What do they all have in common? And that's a good way to start when you're faced with a paradox like this is, okay, we think that helping people is good and volunteering is good and looking after your family is good. You know, what do these things have in common that we can trace down to piety, for example, in this particular case, which they don't do in Euthyphro, but it's a system that does feature, it's an argument that does feature quite often in Socratic dialogues, other ones. Maybe Brandon, you have a particular example to point to, but...
Sorry, I was thinking something.
No, that's okay, but you go ahead, make whatever point you were going to make.
So there's two things that I could say about this. One is just a quick dramatic point about, it's interesting that Euthyphro is saying, well, piety is kind of whatever the gods say, or whatever the gods love, it's kind of, it hinges on them. In a way, what piety's definition is also kind of hinges on Euthyphro here. I mean, he doesn't, because this is one valid form of investigation of going and looking at different examples and then pulling them together and seeing, well, what does piety generally appear as you're talking about? But more or less, we just get the definition from Euthyphro, who Socrates really wants it from him because he's a priest. And so in the dramatic context, there might be something to that.
In a sense, mm-hmm. he is a speaker for the gods, right? That is the role of the priest in that community. So, and you know, in general, that is what a priest is. It's that connection between the human and the divine. And so, you're right. It's almost in a dramatic kind of way. Or if you're going to analyze the actual nature of the writing, it's almost as if he is giving a definition from the gods. That's just like it's what the gods say it is. But of course, Socrates is unhappy with that.
Yeah. But to bring it back to the dilemma itself a little bit, it's interesting that it has the structure of what we call like a circular argument. So the ultimate products are, it's pious because the gods love it, and the gods love it because it's pious. Now, as Aaron was talking about, circles aren't always a problem. It's just they appear to be problems when they get too close. I don't exactly know why that is. I should probably think about that a bit more. We tend to accept when there's a certain distance to it, when it surveys a kind of what I might call a like coherentist epistemology. There's a landscape of beliefs that are all self-sustaining, and they all have healthy distance from each other. They don't collapse into the same thing. This dilemma seems to be a collapse of circular reasoning. And I think one way of thinking about healthy circular reasons might be that in certain ways you'll have circular arguments. It's not so much about escaping the circle, but about getting into the circle in the right way. And I think here Euthyphro has just failed to do that. It's just too tight. It's too close.
Yeah, so just to briefly respond to that before we change topic here a little bit, I think maybe circular arguments that are closer we're more likely to notice them. I mean, if you're having a long argument that eventually circles in on itself, it may be harder to notice that it's circular. And I think the question is like, are we describing a system of things that are interreliant, but it works logically? Or is it actually just a circular argument where you're assuming premises that rely on one another without proving either one, right? There's a bit of a difference there. Before we move on, I just want to remind our listeners that you're listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show. And this is part one of a little two-part series I'm doing on paradoxes in philosophy. So we began by discussing Euthyphro's dilemma and the ancient Greeks and what paradoxes are in general and what they might look like. And we're just wrapping up this discussion on